All right, guys. Hey, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Hey, sorry about missing yesterday, man. I almost even took off today. If I thought I could jump through all the pig's hoops to get my trucks legal all in one day, then I'm naive and ridiculous. Actually, I just didn't think about it hard enough. Anyway, so I jumped through hoops of fire all day yesterday, and I got more to do after the show today. God dang tax stamps. And I'm thinking, you know what? I got a lot of flexibility in this job. I can play hooky for a day. I can take the afternoon off or, you know, reschedule things, push things aside. I do a lot of work other than just the show, but, you know, I'm flexible. What does a real human do in a situation like this, where the government mandates that everyone spend so many hundreds of dollars and so much time? Business hours only. They got shorter business hours at government offices than anywhere else. You can't go after work. They're closed. People got to get fired just to take the time off to jump through the hoops so they can get a car and drive it legally without now owing even more hundreds and hundreds and thousands of dollars in tickets just to get their car legal so they can get to work in the first place. Talk about regressive taxation. I hate government, man. I go through this crap and I think, yeah, Scott Horton, you're so cynical. How could you be an anarchist? Anyway, everybody knows you need a good, big, powerful government to make everybody equal and happy. And I just think, yeah, no, I don't get it where you people think this is tolerable at all. How is this tolerable? Anyway, it's not. And that's the last refuge of the statist, too. What would we do without the roads? Jeez, I don't know. How about the people who use them pay for them in equivalent amount to their use? You know, like a customer. How about turn them all over to private property owners at auction? That's step one. Then two is tax the people, charge the people who actually use them, and leave everybody else the hell alone. How about that? Anyway, you don't need communism to have roads. From each according to his ability to each according to his transportation needs. Really? We can't just have a market in transportation? Why in the hell not? What is this, Germany or something? Sorry, I know I'm off on a tangent, but you people just, you believe in government, but do you really think that you know that you need it? Or you're just used to having one? I hate him. Lou Rockwell, he's a kind man. He says, take all the government employees, or I think he's specifying feds here, but still, I'd settle. Take them all and pay them $100,000 a year to just go on vacation to Bermuda and leave us the hell alone. Let them take the money and just go. And just, you know, it's bad enough they're taking the money and then doing things to us with it. Just go on vacation and leave us alone. I say no, it'd be better to drown them all in the pond. But, man, yeah, I could compromise on these things, you know. It really comes down to it, minarchism versus anarchism, vacation versus mass executions, whatever. Just stop regulating my life, you're driving me crazy. Driver's licenses and tax stamps and inspection stickers should all be free. How about that? That way poor people can get a car and go to work and try to make some money. Sounds crazy, doesn't it? All right. I should have written down a list of all the things I wanted to complain about, because I got so many things to complain about on the show today, and I got three interviews. First of all, some a-hole shot up a bunch of Marines and tried to kill some, what, Navy guys, whatever, yesterday in Chattanooga. The CBS story here I have, thanks to Dan Sanchez. And the guy's name was Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz. Yeah, and he had some blog about can't wait to go to paradise and all this crap. But then he's an American. He was not born here, but he was raised here. He's an American citizen. Everybody knew him, said he was a great kid in school, and his coach in MMA fighting said he was a great guy, and what's the problem, and this and that. Then they say, well, he went to the Middle East. And I believe the last rumor I saw in the headlines before going on the air this morning was that he'd gone to Yemen. So I don't know whether we'll ever find out his story or not. I can guarantee you that his story was not that he hated being free. Anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about Islam and all of this kind of thing here in a minute with Salamal. Oh, man. No, Salam. Boy, I better put a line here. I'm going to end up screwing this guy's name up on the air. I mean, it's pretty much guaranteed anyway, right? Salam Al Mariati. Hey, by the way, chat room guys, help me out. Is it Id or Eid? It's Eid, right? E-I-D, but it's pronounced E-E-D. Is that correct? Or it's pronounced Id, as in Donald Trump. Because it's a holiday. It's an important holiday for Muslims right now. So I want to say happy whatever it is to this guy, but I didn't want to pronounce Christmas wrong, you know what I mean? Anyway, he's going to be on the show to explain why, hey man, moderate Muslims denounce terrorism. Because I think it's important to give a guy a chance to say that. Because I know all the propaganda is, oh, we're all the moderate Muslims denouncing them. Well, they're not on Fox News, but that's because they're not invited on Fox News. And, you know, I saw a picture this morning that pissed me off, man. These, you know, kind of right-wing populist militia types who ought to hate and fear the state gathered out in front of the Texas State Capitol with their government flags, their Texas and U.S. flags, and then their big sign is about Islamic Jihad, bring it on, we're ready for you, and all this. Like, they really believe that there is some Soviet Union-sized Islamic, Islamo-fascist caliphate that is set on invading and conquering North America. Why? Because some jackass shot up a recruiting center. So, yeah, next thing you know, all 10 zillion square miles of Texas are going to have to be fought for by our local militia guys because the government is never going to protect us from the terrorists taking over our society, according to these idiots. Your Muslim neighbors are not your enemy. Although, keep treating them like your enemy, I guess you're going to find them on the margins. What a tragedy this whole thing is. How predictable and self-fulfilling. All at the same time. Like, you know you're going to lose Afghanistan eventually, right? Same kind of thing. You know that if you bomb the Middle East incessantly for a decade and a half, eventually some Muslims here, in very small numbers, obviously, are going to find their solidarity with the Muslim victims as a higher calling than their solidarity with their fellow Americans. And they'll join up the war on the other side. That's what, same thing happened with Faisal Shahzad, the attempted Times Square bomber. He was an American with a good job and a wife and a big house and a, you know, I think a graduate level degree. And then he went home and was living happy, had a great life and friends and everything. Went home to Pakistan. Saw the aftermath of a drone attack, joined up the Pakistani Taliban, and they told him, go back to America, don't fight here, go back to America and fight them there. And thank goodness this bomb was a piece of crap and failed, he could have killed a lot of people. But there was no question about what his motivation was. Hey y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys. Yeah, so Jeff Charlotte has written this thing for GQ about the cop that killed the bum Charlie on Skid Row in L.A. Remember that? Oh, my God, he's got a gun, blah, blah. He didn't have a gun. He didn't take the cop's gun. I don't know if it was just a cold-blooded murder, if the cop, or if possibly the cop was that ridiculously scared and confused and stupid. All the other cops shot him to death, and then, oh, there's your gun, still in your holster, right on your hip. What were you screaming about again? Stop resisting, stop resisting, they yelled at the corpse. At that point, beginning to rot on the sidewalk. Okay, it was the very beginnings of rotting, kicking in there. And Jeff Charlotte is saying, hey, how come nobody cares about this? And it's on video, too. The shooting is on video. And he's, you know, he's not saying, look, I'm not flacking for my article. I'm saying, hey, look, this is the reason he did the article in the first place, man. They killed this guy. And then he got sources who leaked who let him see the body cam footage and told him all kinds of stuff. He wrote a great article about it. You know, 3,000 or 4,000 words or whatever, I don't know, where he really did good work on it. But it didn't make the list. And he's saying, come on, it's not like the murder of this guy takes away from the murder of the other guys who are, you know, who became the cause celeb or whatever. So what is it? And the answer is, oh, and he also brought up John Crawford, shot at the Walmart with the BB gun. And the answer, of course, is, well, there's a few, but one of them is, he's got a gun. Sorta, kinda, maybe. And so, the cop has so much better of an excuse compared to killing someone who has no gun at all. Tamir Rice was a 12-year-old boy with a toy gun who did not point it at the cops and who was not told repeatedly to drop it or any of this stuff like the lying murderer cops claimed after they murdered him and lied about it and tried to prevent help from getting to him, beat the crap out of his little sister, or sorry, his big sister who came to try to comfort him as he died. Well, I guess he died the next day, but still, they were trying to hope he would bleed out. They're praying he would bleed out right there on the spot. Unfortunately for them, the FBI agent happened to be in the neighborhood and went, oh my God, this is a child! And saved the boy's life for a day. But anyway, had a gun. And so somewhere, it's not that there's a committee of the Black Lives Matter committee or whatever, but among liberals and leftists and commies and progressives, having a gun is a crime. Having a gun is a horrible assault. Having a gun is a reason to get killed, or at least it becomes very debatable. Whereas the case where, you know, the guy does not have a gun, Freddie Gray, the guy who is running away and the cop just straight up executes him, shoots him 5 times in the back, and pause before the 5th shot. The cop gets frustrated that his 4 shots haven't murdered the guy all the way yet, and you can see he takes a second and firms up his aim again and then blam through the heart. Now that's one where like, holy crap, now don't you tell me he was threatening you with a taser or whatever, when you come up and plant the taser on his corpse after you murdered him. Lying murderer. Now that's clear cut. Now to me, killing John Crawford, who's in the Walmart, in case you forgot, John Crawford was gonna buy a BB gun. He picked it up off the shelf at the Walmart. He was talking on the phone and kind of swinging it around mindlessly, you know, holding it. the footage shows that when the cops came up, he had it on his shoulder like a Continental Soldier, whatever, right? Where he's like holding the bottom of it. And it's leaning up against his shoulder. And he's just talking on the phone. And the cops just come up and waste him. Well, terrified white guy called 911. There's a black guy with a rifle in the Walmart, except that it was a BB gun he picked up off the shelf. And of course, the Walmart employees did nothing to protect him whatsoever, to intervene whatsoever. What do you mean, black guy with a rifle? There's not a black guy with a rifle. Wait a minute. Let's see if we can resolve this. Nope. Cops go and execute him. But anyway, so that's the reason. And it's a big part of the reason why I'm always trying to emphasize to the left that your gun control fantasies are just moot and, in fact, stupid. Okay? We live in a society of 300 million guns. 300 million privately owned firearms. Now, they're owned by approximately half of the population, 150 million Americans, somewhere right around there. I'm probably behind on my statistics. These aren't the latest ones, but this is, you know, from a few years ago. Close enough. Okay? Those people are not criminals just because you're not one of them. And you don't have the right to take their property away, whatever it is, in the first place. It is not an aggressive threat for them to own a tool of defense. The fact that it's 150 million Americans own them prove that it's a tool of defense and not some, you know, simply a tool of aggression and murder. Because we sure don't have 150 million murders in America a year, do we? Well, pretty close, but that's just the cops. But anyway, the point is this. When you make gun possession a crime, that means anyone with a gun, even in some ways, right? It's a crime for some people to own some guns some of the time and whatever for all your different little rules. What that means is, in the minds of the cops, people with a gun are more likely to be criminals rather than simply free men and women who own firearms. What's the big deal? What the hell is this? Russia or something? Of course they own firearms. They're humans. What's the big deal? So the cops basically act as though anyone who has a gun in their hand is a would-be cop killer. Is just waiting for the chance to get the electric chair for killing a cop, right? Which we all know, reasonably speaking, that even hardened criminals wouldn't kill a cop most of the time. And maybe some of them would. And maybe if they're caught red-handed, cornered, fight or flight, they would. But come on, kill a cop? Even serious-ass gangsters know that sometimes it's better to do 20 than to get the death penalty. It is the smallest percentage of American criminals you could, you know, of the American population who would even fathom shooting a cop. But a cop sees a 93-year-old woman with a gun in her hand. He still goes, "Drop it!" And of course she's thinking, huh? She doesn't have time to articulate to him that I'm the property owner. I'm the one who called 911. Protect me. The bad guy's over there. Why are you screaming at me? Right? She can't say that. She's a 93-year-old woman. She's startled. She's stunned. She's not pointing the gun at the cop. Drop it, I said. Pow, 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 pow. She's dead. That's what Steven Stern did. Killed a 93-year-old woman. Happens every day because of gun control. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. First up today is Salam al-Mariati from the Muslim Public Affairs Council. That's MPAC.org. MPAC.org. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, so Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, apparently, is the name of the shooter from the Chattanooga massacre yesterday, killed four Marines and attempted to kill some Navy men, I believe it is. And all over the Daily Beast, they say they found his blog, and it's all about going to paradise and all of these things. And so I guess Islam made him do it. And the burden is on you to prove that all Muslims in the world aren't guilty of the crime that he committed. So go right ahead.
Well, first of all, I think, you know, number one, there is definitely a force called ISIS and violent extremists that are setting up this narrative that it's the job of Muslims to go and kill Christians and Jews. So there's definitely a scourge within the communities that have that problem. And the reality, however, is that the majority of Muslims stand against that and are fighting against that. And we should not fall into the trap of thinking that ISIS represents the faith. If that's the case, then we are going to go down that path of a religious war where there are no winners. I think we have to divide the world not between religion, but divide the world between those who promote the cult of death and those who are trying to work for life. And the Marines are those who represent the ones who are living and dying for our freedom. So I side with the Marines, and I believe that the way to deal with ISIS is to isolate them and not isolate the vast majority of American Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very big of you. I wouldn't go so far as to say that.
No, it's not big of me. Let's not patronize.
Well, okay, so let's not. I mean, the Marines aren't fighting for our freedom at all. The Marines are destroying our freedom by waging endless war across the world at the behest of criminal politicians, and they're creating enemies for the American people all the time. And that's certainly no rationalization for the murder that happened yesterday, but I don't think you need to pretend like they're fighting for our freedom. Give me a break. We've done nothing but lose freedom daily since the war on terror began.
The Marines?
Well...
You're talking about the Marines?
Well, they help make it all possible. I mean, them and the Army and the Air Force, they wage the war that justifies the loss of our freedom that creates more enemies for us. Look at what's happening in Fallujah right now.
You're mixing up two things. You're mixing up our bad policies, and then with the Marines who've dedicated their lives to serve us. So at least I'm talking about the individuals who are serving us. Yes, we have a lot of bad policies. We can talk about that, but let's not mix up the two.
Well, again, I'm not saying that those four guys deserve to be attacked or anything like that. I'm just saying I can't think of a time where a U.S. Marine fought for America's freedom, the American people's freedom ever. What, when we were going to be conquered by the North Koreans back in the 50s, if the Marines hadn't held them at bay? I mean, the whole thing's a joke. America is the empire waging war in other people's countries. They're not defending our freedom from any foreign attack.
Like I said, we can talk about the policies and how bad they are and, you know, have a conversation about that. Something else.
The point is...
But anyway.
Yeah, the point is that... Well, here's the thing about this. Okay? Even when the FBI entraps some idiot into an attack, they don't tell him Islam mandates you do this. They tell him, don't you hate American foreign policy that is hurting your fellow Muslims? That's how even the FBI motivates someone into incriminating themselves in a terrorist thing. However, in this case, this guy, I mean, they're saying he went to Yemen and all that. We don't know his whole story and all that. But his blog seems, you know, very religiously based, and rather than attacking American policy in specific. So I wonder, I mean, I guess I have to assume that's going to hand a lot of talking points to the right that, see, it's all about Islam. Islam makes them do it. So how do you dispute that?
But the reality is any idiot can use any excuse to do that. I mean, you can come up with any idea and theory, and, you know, if it's meant to kill people, then that's what it is. It has nothing to do with the values that you espouse. If you murder, you're a murderer. You can espouse all the great values in life, but you're a murderer and you're a criminal. The other thing is that, you know, on these cases of trying to deal with the threat of ISIS to our families here, what we've done is create a program called Safe Spaces, where we're raising awareness. We're calling for intervention when a mother or a father or a friend finds somebody who's troubled, a troubled lost soul, going down that path of violent extremism. So, I mean, we're doing what we can, and we're working with the government. I think there's a lot more that can be done, and obviously, I think, as you're alluding, there are a lot of policies that need to be reviewed that are root causes of some of these problems, but it's a complex issue. There's no single answer.
Right. Yeah, well, it certainly is, and I think, you know, one of the terrible things that's happened here is because the war has gone on for so long, you know, the what was a pretty marginal view has become much more popular, especially on the right in America, that basically we're in a civilizational war here, and Islam makes them hate us, and so all we can do is fight them. What are we going to do? You know, win them over with kindness when their religion mandates a perpetual war against the middle part of North America forever? And so even though that's not how this thing started, the longer it goes on, the further that myth is reinforced, and people start really suspecting. I mean, like, this guy was, you know, virtually born and raised here. He was raised here. He's considered an American. Everybody in school liked him, and he fit into the community and this kind of thing. He's not a foreign terrorist who snuck in here. He's an American who turned against us. And that really plays into the myth, I think.
He was probably, and again, we're all speculating. We really don't know the facts, but more than likely he was influenced by a foreign ideology. That ideology has no traction or footing anywhere in the United States.
We'll talk more about that then, because I think, you know, tell, you know, right-wing talk radio audiences that that's the case, and they just couldn't believe you. They assume that all Muslims are out to get them, basically, or else what are you doing here?
Yeah, well, I mean, the facts speak. I mean, there are Muslims who serve in our military. There are Muslims who serve in our law enforcement. There's Muslims who serve as doctors and teachers, and that's the vast majority. I mean, just have to, you know, accept those facts. But I agree with you. I mean, some people just don't want to deal with the facts. They have their theories, and basically deny any truth that debunks that those myths, and just continue parroting talking points that basically are out to create a religious war. And that's exactly what ISIS wants.
Right. See, this is the thing of it, too, that people never really think about for some reason is, you know, they get angry and they react without realizing that that's the whole point of the enemy making them angry, is to try to get us to react. ISIS doesn't have any real power in the world. So the best thing that they can do to us is try to manipulate us, you know?
Exactly. They pose no existential threat to the United States. They terrorize. They are a terrorist group, and terrorism only succeeds when there is an audience. And if we take away an audience, the audience from terrorists, then they become irrelevant.
All right. Well, listen, sorry about the whole diversion of the conversation there. It's very important that you say the things you say. So I really appreciate the work you're doing there and
no
coming
problem
on the show today.
Good to talk to you.
Okay, thanks. That's Salam al-Mariati. He's at MPAC, the Muslim Public Affairs Council. MPAC condemns shooting at military recruiting center.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I botched that interview. I shouldn't have quibbled with him about the Marines, man. He was just being a good American. I went and tried to make a point and all this crap. But I just hate that from anyone, fighting for our freedom. Come on, man. I'm fighting for the empire. Any 17-year-old ought to know better. I'm not saying they have no excuse to not know better, because, come on, 17-year-old kids, they're stupid. They don't know anything. But I knew better by the time I was 17. They probably wouldn't have let me in anyway, but come on, fighting for our freedom. It's so pat, it couldn't possibly be right. Anyway, whatever. So coming up on the show, did I tell you Bill Green is going to be on? I'm not going to tell you why, because you know why? Because this is a surprise. Yes, sir. Oh, man, I better figure out what the hell I'm doing here. Oh, I see. Huh. Okay. All right, man, so I got a bunch of stuff to talk about. Gareth is coming on, too. Dig that. I called him this morning. I said, so will you do my show today then, please? Oh, no, I haven't read his new article. Only read the first one, not the second. How three of the Iran negotiations' toughest issues were resolved. Well, okay, I'll cram that into my eye holes during the break. That should be fine. All right. So I've done two interviews. I did the Mark Claire show last night, and I did the Tom Woods show yesterday, which means it's playing either today or tomorrow, I guess. Oh, today's Friday. So if it's not playing today, I guess it'll play Monday. But I did the Mark Claire show and the Tom Woods show on the subject of the Iran deal and Rand and his sellout on it. Anyway, if you want to listen to those, I'll tell you what, I got an email from a relative yesterday asking me, well, what do you think about this article? And it was a thing in the American Thinker, who they're very right-wing war party types. And the article was, oh, this is all the Republicans' fault. The Iran deal is so horrible, that goes without saying, but the Republicans voted for the deal that gave Obama the power to get away with it. Only Tom Cotton stood firm against it. And so I was asked by this relative, well, what do you think of this? And so here's what I responded. This article is total nonsense. This Iran deal is the one thing Obama has done right this whole time he's been in office. Iran was never making nuclear bombs, just electricity. And now this deal extra double super duper verifies that that remains the case. They will only have very small amounts of uranium enriched to very low percentages of the good stuff, 3.6% U-235 as opposed to over 90% for weapons grade. And the inspections and verifications regime that they are already under will be expanded beyond any in world history. The warmongers now crying about the deal are the same ones who pretend to be worried about an Iran with nuclear weapons,
when this is the best deal anyone could have ever hoped to have gotten out of them to prevent them from ever doing so. Iran was never, ever going to give up their entire nuclear program. There is no, quote, better deal Obama could have gotten, and the warmongers know it. And so the reason why the warmongers hate the deal is that they don't really care about Iran's civilian nuclear electricity program, which never was a real threat and is now even less so. They want a war and an excuse for a war. The war party needs us to believe that all their slogans about crazy mullahs and Islamic extremists and they only understand one thing, force, and all these things so that we'll support a war. So this deal drives them crazy because it proves that the Iranian government is run by right-wing, conservative, very human politicians just like themselves, and they very obviously, in fact, can be dealt with. And so the excuses for war are obviously hollow. And then I say, by the way, I hate their guts for what they did in Iraq, and I hate them for being politicians, and I ain't like them. I'm just interested in the truth and peace, so don't get me wrong, like I'm some damned Democrat. So, I don't know why I just read that to you other than I'm lazy, but I figured, you know, that was a pretty good kind of, you know, teach you the facts and my position all at once. I tried to make it as brief as possible. And, anyway, so that's my answer. That's the deal. All these people who act like, well, you know, it's funny. When I was a little kid, most of the Cold War history all took place before I was ever alive, right? So you hear about, you know, SALT Treaty 1 and SALT Treaty 2 and START Treaty this and this and that and whatever. And what do I know about the politics of how those deals were done? They all just seem like the inevitable history of the Cold War, that we got this Cold War, but we also do have some treaties that limit atmospheric testing and these other things and whatever, right? But of course, throughout, you had people who said that every one of those treaties were treason. Every one of those treaties meant giving up everything to the USSR, and now they're going to kill us all and whatever, whatever, whatever. They all seem so inevitable and just fine, and thank goodness we have them. And thank God that our government still isn't in a hydrogen bomb atmosphere testing pissing contest with the Russians, for God's sake. So this is just another one of those. And you always got these right-wing cranks who oppose anything that could possibly lead to more peace and less conflict. But you'll notice, for example, in the National Review today, yesterday, Charles Krauthammer says Obama's nuclear deal with Iran worse than we could have imagined. But there's no details in it at all. He doesn't even talk about the deal. He doesn't even talk about what's wrong with the deal. He talks about, well, they're going to lift the arms embargo. Well, the arms embargo is part of the group of sanctions from the United Nations based around the premise of the nuclear deal, the nuclear program. And anyway, the arms embargo isn't even scheduled to be lifted for 10 years, or is it 15? Wait, I have it here. These guys put out a great little bar graph that has all this crap on it. It's not on there. Well, whatever. Anyway, I think it's 10 years before the arms embargo is even lifted anyway. And then by then, if they've been abiding by the deal all along, then who cares if, you know, American companies are selling them weapons. I think he says in here, oh, but the Russians and the Chinese could sell them supersonic sea-skimming missiles. They already have. That's not a game changer. That's the game as it exists, as it has been for 10 years. They've had the sunburn, and then there's one other kind, too. Always forget. But don't worry, you guys got the Aegis radar, and you're just fine, right? Is it Aegis or Aegis? Always forget. Anyway, this whole article is basically just a bunch of harumphing. There's nothing even in here. And then they pretend, oh yeah, so much for anytime, anywhere inspections. That's the one part where they even talk about the deal. Oh no, it's completely farcical.
because they can delay up to 24 days before the inspection of any military facilities. Yeah, but this is all about Parchin, where they never were doing nuke testing anyway. That whole thing is bogus anyway. The nuclear testing chamber there, Robert Kelly of the IAEA himself already debunked all of that. They already went to Parchin. And even if that story was true and not thoroughly debunked by Gareth Porter's and other about the so-called Soviet-era nuclear scientist who helped them with that implosion chamber, who was not a nuclear scientist at all, in fact, and his expertise was nanodiamonds and not setting off nuclear chain reactions. But anyway, that was years ago, and all that stuff ceased to exist a long time ago. They don't have any indication. There's no reason to believe that the Iranians are under the now expanded inspection regime, an expanded brand new deal with the UN Security Council, that now, not before when it would have been way easier to get away with it, now they're going to have little secret sneak projects on their military bases to try to test and create nuclear weapons right under the nose of everybody, under the most expansive inspection regime ever. Give me a break. The whole thing is just a joke. The whole thing is just based on a bunch of unsaid and unproven presumptions. But what's his comment about the scaling back of Natanz and Iraq and Fordo? And the expanded inspections at the mines and the centrifuge facilities? Never gets to that part. That's a pretty damn good deal, actually. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. On the line now, I got Bill Green. He teaches political science at South Texas College down there near Brownsville. And he's written a couple of papers for the Mises Institute about this brand new Texas law. I almost can't believe it. Creating a, I'll let him explain exactly what it creates. Welcome to the show, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you joining us here. So they're legalizing gold as a Texas currency, is that it? Or what exactly are they doing?
Well, it's interesting. What they have done is Governor Abbott just signed into law recently this bill that establishes a gold and other precious metals depository for the state of Texas. And so what this basically means is that Texas is going to be putting all of its gold, and it holds substantial gold, actually, but it's being held up in New York, ostensibly by the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. And so Texas is going to be demanding their gold to be returned to them. They're going to put it in this depository that the law just established, and then the state and citizens are going to be able to use that depository once it gets set up properly and everything, then be able to use that depository in order to make transactions. It'll operate in many ways along the lines of sort of a proto bank. So it's almost like a hard currency bank. It's not really a bank, but it is the first step towards establishing a sound money bank, basically.
Well, it kind of almost sounds like a big safe deposit box for people, to just a safe place to put their gold. No, or it's more.
Well,
than that?
In one way, it is. It is a safe place to put your gold, your silver, whatever precious metals. You
I mean,
have.
Assuming you trust the state of Texas any more than the national government.
but they, so it's a place to put it there. And if you have trust in the state government, then you, you'll trust that. But it's also, it goes beyond that. One of the things that it does is it establishes that gold and silver, specifically legal tender gold and silver that's minted by the U.S. Mint, is actual money and can be used as such by the state and by the citizens. And this is a remarkable step forward towards getting states to go back to what the Constitution originally required them to do, which was to only use gold and silver coin as a, you know, as a payment, an acceptable payment for debts both to and from the state.
But now, so are they going to find themselves in conflict?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, are they going to find... Well, no, go ahead. I'll save my question. You're going to say the other thing it does?
The other thing it does is, as I was saying, it allows just regular people to also use that, to use their precious metals on an everyday basis. I mean, once this gets established and people can start basically writing checks off of what they have in there, and then once it moves to being able to use things like debit cards, and you have automatic translation, automatic conversion of gold and silver to Federal Reserve notes and back again, then you're going to be able to start using this just like you use any other money. And that would be a major step forward to returning to sound money in this country and getting rid of those funny notes from the Federal Reserve.
Man, this is so cool. Maybe. First of
maybe,
all,
yeah.
Are they going to have a problem with the supremacy clause challenging, are they in effect challenging the federal government's legal tender laws or not?
No, because it really doesn't do anything, to directly against the legal tender laws, against the Federal Reserve itself. What it does, the challenge that it really represents is once people are able to start using gold and silver on a regular basis, and use it, you know, as money, as it was, as we used to do, then people who aren't used to doing that anymore, people are going to very quickly realize that, hey, this stuff actually holds its value in the long term much better than these pieces of paper with dead politicians on it. And I'm going to start, you know, saving my money this way. I'm going to start using my money this way. I'm not going to use these things that are losing value on such a rapid basis to the point where, I mean, you know, as you know, the Federal Reserve note, our dollar has lost over 95% of its value since the establishment of the Federal Reserve. But gold and silver in the long term hold their value. And so once people start seeing that on a day-to-day basis, then they will stop using Federal Reserve notes the way that they've been using them. And there's it won't be long, really, until the Federal Reserve is simply an irrelevant institution, especially when it comes to the manufacturing of funny money.
All right, well, you're singing my song. There's no doubt about that, Professor. But now hold on a minute. I found you because of this quote about the reverse Gresham's Law. This is what you're talking about. This is going to take off, and it's going to keep taking off better and better and better. But Gresham's Law, and I'm no economist. I'm an anti-war guy, really. But it makes a lot of sense to me that if I can buy gold certificates with Federal Reserve notes and that the Federal Reserve notes are going to depreciate and the gold certificates are not, that what's going to happen is I'm not going to trade with my gold certificates. I'm going to trade with my Federal Reserve notes, and then on the margin, whatever I can save, I'm going to keep as many gold notes as I can because the good money drives out bad, and that's why it drives out bad. Why would I want to hold on to a Federal Reserve note and save that when I could save this gold receipt instead? But you're saying that this is going to be such a good deal that it's going to not just overcome the Gresham's Law but reverse it. So I don't understand.
Well, that's a fantastic point. I think it's probably one of the main objections to why do this in the first place, besides the fact that it's really constitutionally required that states do this, but none of them do it. And that is, Gresham's Law says that good money drives out bad, but that's not all it says. Good money drives out bad when you have legal tender laws.
Oh, I thought it was bad money drives out good. I got it all confusing.
I'm sorry. Bad money drives out good. That's what I meant to say. Because the reverse of Gresham's Law is something called Thiers' Law, which is that's when good money drives out bad. Thiers' Law takes effect when you don't have to use the bad money, when it's not a requirement that you use the bad money. Right now, because of legal tender laws, we can't use gold and silver. I mean, we can, but we would be idiots to do so, because the legal tender gold and silver, as you know, if you have a 1 ounce, you know, a silver dollar that the Mint puts out right now, that's 1 ounce of silver in that thing. But it's only got a face value of $1. I'd be an idiot to spend that in a store somewhere, because I'm only going to get a dollar's worth of stuff that you could normally get with Federal Reserve notes, instead of the, you know, $20 or so that you, that it would be worth in Federal Reserve notes if I were to convert it. The same with $50 gold coins. They have a face value of $50, but they have an ounce of gold in them. So I'd be a triple fool to try to spend that for only $50. However, with something like this new depository, once it gets rolling in the sense to be able to use it for transactions, those transactions are supposed to be in the actual value of the precious metals themselves, not the face value of the coins. And once that occurs, then when you have conversion take place, which is automatic. I mean, when you go in and use your, say, your ATM, your debit card at Walmart, then it's just like anything else. There's an automatic conversion. If you are somewhere that doesn't normally take Federal Reserve notes, well, you would have, it would, if it doesn't normally take gold or silver coins, it would convert it to Federal Reserve notes, whatever the equivalent value is. You can do this now, and in fact, I have a debit card right now that is really a secure credit card that is backed by silver that I have put into an account. That there are, you know, this is computers that do this stuff for us now, and so it automatically converts the silver that I have in that account into Federal Reserve notes. That silver then is taken out of that account, and if I want more in there, I can put it in there. So it's not a difficult thing to do. It's not like the old days where you'd have to carry around gold and silver in your pocket. Right. With this sort of thing, it's going to be just using it like money, and that's when the good stuff starts happening.
Okay. Hey, great. Thanks so much for your time on the show. I really appreciate the good news, Bill.
Absolutely. And go to constitutionaltender.com for more information on it.
Okay, great. Constitutionaltender.com. We'll be right back, y'all. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Yeah, I would have kept interviewing that guy, Bill Green's his name, professor at South Texas College. His website, again, constitutionaltender.com, and has written a couple of things for Mises.org about this new Texas gold thingy, and I just didn't know enough to ask him another 10 minutes worth of questions. I don't know. I mean, I could have thought of a lot of horrible things to say about the central bank and how much I hate them and whatever, but those aren't really questions for an interview. And there's so much other important stuff. Let me say one thing, though. I totally dig the concept of the coin, of using gold and or silver coins without a face value on them. That's why I never liked Von. That's one of the reasons I never liked Von Nothaus and the Liberty Dollar. It's because he would write a face value on it. But who says? Von Nothaus? Silver's trading at $8.50, so he raised the face value from 10 to 20. Huh? But now Arlo Piñati, he always sort of, kind of, but not really agreed with my criticism. But then check it out. He invented the greatest money ever. The QR code commodity disc. You scan it with your phone, and it tells you how much it's worth on the market right now. It gives you the instant spot price. That's it. It says scan back side for value. Perfect. And that's how this guy's saying the new Texas money is going to be based somewhat along those lines. He didn't say anything about the QR code. But it'll have, it'll trade at its daily market value in dollars. Whatever. Good. But that way, you're not telling the shopkeeper, yeah, this is worth $20, when no, it's not. You're just telling the shopkeeper, beep, it's worth $20. And it is. All right. Anyway, I think that's great. And if you want to know how to get one, go to commoditydiscs.com. And if you want to know how to help the show and get one, donate $100 to the show and you get a commodity disc. And in fact, even though the drawing is over, congratulations again to John, oh no. Wait, I have it here. How'd I forget his name all of a sudden? I know it. I just forgot. Cornish. John Cornish, of course. He won the raffle, but I still got a pile of Sheldon Richman books and Charles Goyette books. So anybody who donates $100 to the show, you get a QR code, commodity disc, and your choice of either Goyette or Richman there. And in fact, I still have a handful, I think, a few Lou Rockwell audiobooks to give away too. The codes for those. I still have a few of those. So anybody who donates $100 to the show, maybe we'll just make it the perpetual fund drive. You get a QR code, commodity disc, and a choice of one of those three books. The audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me. All right, cool. All right, now important news that I didn't get to before Gareth Porter comes on the show in just a minute. So, I should have got Patrick Coburn on the show today. Anyway, got to read Patrick Coburn, man. Read Prothero, too, at McClatchy. Both of them have stories about thousands, tens of thousands of Shiite militiamen descending on Fallujah. I think they're going to get their clocks cleaned. I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll see. But I'm pretty sure that the Islamic State is going to really fight for Fallujah. And now the Shiite militias are backed by America and Iran at the same time. So, but man, they're not on their own territory. And they're militia guys. How well trained are they? How heavily armed are they, really? I don't know. And if they do win, what's going to be the backlash and the consequences from that? The Shiite militias take over Fallujah. Are they going to keep it? Holy crap, wouldn't that be something? Anyway, you go to UNZ.com, U-N-Z, UNZ.com, and you can read all of Patrick Coburn without dealing with the independence paywall there, okay? UNZ.com. And then I think this is important, this story in The Intercept by Murtaza Hussein. Retired general, drones create more terrorists than they kill. Iraq war helped to create the Islamic State. And all it is it's newsworthy, it's shocking. General Mike Flynn, who is saying we ought to be doing more to fight against the Islamic State and their enemy, Iran, at the same time. So it's not like he's a good guy. He's being very frank and saying, yes, the Iraq war, he says, just like my old article that I wrote 10 years ago, throwing fuel on the fire. He said, took a terrorism problem that hardly existed in 2003. That was virtually defeated in 2003 and blew it up into what it is today by overthrowing Saddam. Absolutely, there's no doubt, he says. I mean, history will not be kind to the decisions that were made, certainly in 2003. And you're damn right about that. They might have even asked him, did the 1990s exist? Did George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton murder anyone then? Did they occupy anybody's holy sites then? Did they back the Israelis' occupation of one or more peoples? Because I wonder if that helped throw fuel on the fire that was but a cinder at the end of the 80s Afghan war when America was on the side of the bin Ladenites. Wonder what he would have said. Yeah, of course. Bill Clinton got us into this mess. Everybody knows that. Anyway. Exiled officials reach Yemen's Aden. Former president insists city key vows to see the whole rest of the country captured from Aden. So, wow, Hadi is there. They've driven the Houthis out of Aden. And the war continues, so I guess what that means is no ceasefire coming soon. They think they're winning. They got a way to go. I don't know. Air power is merely air power, but then again, it's pretty damn deadly, assuming they get their targets right at all. I don't know. The Houthis have been on a roll, but it could be they've bitten off more than they can chew. Apparently, they withdrew from Aden so far that they felt good about going ahead and bringing the politicians in. There's no way that this guy Hadi is ever going to really end up being the ruler of Yemen. Maybe if the country breaks up, him and his people can keep part of it. Does he even have any people? He's Saleh's former vice president. You know, in Egypt, when the people forced Mubarak out, America tried to keep Suleiman as deputy, but that didn't work. But in Yemen, that the same scheme worked. They got rid of Saleh, but they kept his vice president. But Saleh had been the dictator for 30 years and has all kinds of people loyal to him and that he can manipulate. But this guy, Hadi, never had it together. And now he's the ally of the Saudis who are bombing everybody. There's no way he's going to rule that country again, so that war is going to go on. Also, Obama bombed Somalia yesterday, killed 30 people, supposedly all bad guys. Yeah, right. Mullah Omar pokes his head out to endorse peace talks with the Kabul government. ISIS shot a missile at an Egyptian ship in the Med. Libyan war rages on. Ukraine, oh, no time to tell you about Ukraine. Hey, all Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place. And features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Ladies and gentlemen, the great Dr. Gareth Porter! All right. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I got Gareth Porter on the line. How are you doing, Gareth?
Hi, Scott. Glad to be back again.
Very happy to have you. All those people, they were clapping because due to your work in great measure, a very important step toward a very possible peace has been made. And I know you go, oh, yeah, I'm humble and modest and this and that. But the truth of the matter is, as I told Mohammed Sahimi the other day, there are a very small number of people, experts, journalists, pundits, wonks, etc. in America who have made it their business to debunk the propaganda, the scaremongering, warmongering lies about Iran's nuclear program and why it means we ought to have a war against them. And above all of them, you debunked more lies just in terms of sheer quantity and, of course, in quality, in taking on, completely debunking the story of the alleged studies, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on. You wrote the book on it, Manufactured Crisis, Why They're Lying to You About Iran's Nuclear Program, or whatever the subtitle was. And so thank you, Gareth, and congratulations. This is, you know, it belongs to you, this victory.
Well, Scott, you know that I regard your remarks as extremely kind, and in fact, far too kind, in the sense that realistically, what I've written has had no impact whatsoever on U.S. policy. I think we both really know that.
No, that's not true.
I'm afraid to say that I have to disagree with you there. This is a fundamental disagreement, and I'm going to have to insist on my position on this because it does relate to what we're going to talk about today.
No. Come on. Our government's narrative, the entire establishment's narrative, Israel's narrative, the media's narrative is Iran's illicit nuclear weapons program. And the reason that they didn't get away with continuing to insist that that was the crisis is because there were enough Americans for people to go to show that that wasn't the case, to show that at least that was a dispute. It was not a matter of fact. And so I know that your name is not all over CNN and whatever as, you know, the book that changed the entire game or whatever. But it doesn't have to be. And well, and I appreciate your modesty. Yeah. It's a virtue of yours, but you shouldn't be in denial about it. You know, it's important work.
Well, let me present my analysis on the current situation, which is really based on an entirely different picture of the situation, and that is that, as I prepared for this interview, and this is one of the few times that I've really consciously tried to stop and think, what do I really want to say about the nuclear deal at this moment? I had occasion to go back to the quote in Ron Suskind's article, Faith, Certainty in the Presidency of George W. Bush, which has been attributed now, the quote has been attributed to Karl Rove, and what this unnamed person said is, in response to what he called the reality-based community, who believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality, this person, who is an aide to George W. Bush, said, quote, "That's not the way the world really works anymore. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too. And that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." And so I thought about that because it seems to me that what we are confronted with in this situation is it's an agreement that, of course, it's good. It's a good thing. It's better than the failure to have an agreement, which would bring us closer to war and would give greater power to the neoconservatives and the pro-Israeli lobby and Israel. But at the same time, we have to recognize the fact that this whole this deal is based on a constructed reality by the Obama administration, because they're the ones who created this deal. They're the ones who got into the negotiations, finally. They have constructed it in a way that falsifies the entire reality of the Iranian nuclear program. And so what I'm trying to say is that, I have very, very mixed feelings about the agreement. It depends on which level you want to approach it at, which level you want to analyze it on. And, I think it's important to go to a deeper level here to understand just how far we have been taken into, a kind of alternative political universe by the Obama administration in this whole situation. And, of course, the news media has its own version of that alternative universe, that alternative reality, which is far to the right of the Obama administration. And you correctly point out the distinction, or at least that was the implication of what you said. But I just want to remind everybody listening, and I think this is, perhaps the only audience that I feel free to begin an interview with this sort of analysis, that we are, in fact, confronted with this constructed false alternative reality that has been surrounding the whole question of the Iranian nuclear program in the way the Obama administration has presented the issue, and the result is going to continue that alternative reality. So that's where I want to begin the interview.
I see what you mean. So yeah. In other words, Obama accepts all the premises about just what a terrible,
exactly.
nefarious regime Iran is. He needs all that as part of his argument, the way he's constructed it, to why we need this nuclear deal so bad. But then you're saying he's ultimately given away the store, that,
well,
that
I mean,
he's helped characterize Iran as so unreasonable that even this deal isn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, his construction of the alternative reality is that had it not been for his heroic efforts to put pressure on Iran and bring them to the table and force them to accept our red lines, mm-hmm. Iran would be racing toward a nuclear weapon. I mean, that's not stated as explicitly as that, but clearly that's the message. And it's not, by the way, just because of his need for a rationale to defend his agreement. It's also a part of the larger reality here that the Obama administration is deeply embedded in an alternative reality about the Middle East in general. And I'm sure, you know, we've talked about it on your show, and I'm sure others have as well. But, you know, it really is important to just understand how far the Obama administration has taken us into this false construction of reality. Mm-hmm. You know, in some ways, it goes beyond even what the Bush administration did. And that's pretty bad.
Yeah. Well, now, what's funny is, at the same time, the War Party is starting to abandon their entire line about the nuclear program. Bill Kristol, the grand poobah propagandist of the neocons from the Weekly Standard, tweeted out a quote of Aaron David Miller saying, well, the Iranians have given up something they didn't have in exchange
right.
for a lot of money. Now,
right.
first of all, of course, it's their money that America's been stealing. It's not like America's putting them on the dole now. We're
yeah.
just now going to stop stealing it so much. So that's one thing. But then the second thing is, that's right. They're giving up something they never had, because the neoconservative war party, led by Bill Kristol, of all people, have pushed this myth and this narrative of the danger of Iran's nuclear program all along so badly that what Obama has done basically is made a deal to lift all the sanctions in exchange for Iran to continue doing exactly what they're doing, which is not making nuclear weapons, staying
right,
within the safeguards agreement, only even more so. I mean, obviously, there are new conditions and they're scaling back their program, et cetera. But that's right, because
but
they
course,
lied
so,
us into this situation. That's the kind of deal that they had to make. Look, your safeguards agreement isn't enough. Sign the additional protocol and we'll lift the sanctions. Right.
But,
that's
but
what just
God,
happened.
Crystal's not abandoning the argument. I mean, he's simply saying that, oh, the Iranians didn't really give up anything significant in this. They still, you know, maintain the ability to go for a bomb. This is part of the backstory that they're going to continue to insist on. And again, I mean, I would just point out that the Obama administration is still hyping the idea that Iran wants to have a nuclear weapon. You know, that's the explicit position that they're taking. And that this agreement is the alternative to Iran either getting a nuclear weapon or that we'll have a war with them. And that's really buying, you know, into the most basic lies that were passed on to the administration by the neoconservatives. I mean, so there's still a great deal of agreement simply on the nuclear issue between the neoconservatives and Obama. But also that Obama is pushing this line about Iran as the aggressor in the Middle East as a fundamental aspect, you know, the fundamental basis of its foreign policy in the region. And, I mean, this has gotten much worse in recent months, and we all know why that's the case. It's a response to pressures from the U.S. allies in the region. And the Obama administration really doesn't have its own take on what's going on in the Middle East. It's simply absorbs the pressures and responds with policies that try to deflect and to soften the pressures from its allies, because what's really important to this administration, to the national security state of this administration, which is really what the White House adheres to, is the fundamental interests that involve military bases and the military budget and the contracts that go to all these Middle Eastern allies, particularly the Sunni Arab bloc, which are going to keep the Pentagon and the generals swimming in lots of power and money for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
So That's what we're up against. And, you know, I just did not want to sort of start a commentary on the agreement without establishing really firmly just how bad the situation is in terms of this alternative constructed reality.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're right. Of course, Obama has pushed this whole thing, pushed that whole narrative in order that he can be the one who solves it. But then again, if it's a year from now, a year and a half from now, and they really have turned off Fordo and reconnoitered the Iraq reactor, and they've, you know, unplugged their cascading centrifuges by the thousands at Natanz, and they've expanded all these inspections, and the goons have been out and looked at empty warehouses at the Parchin military base again and whatever, then, I mean, I guess, am I just completely naive this whole time to think, well, if we had a deal, then at least it'll be easier to argue that, no, come on, we got a deal. If the NPT and the safeguards agreement weren't enough for you, now we got an additional protocol. Now we got an additional this, that, and the other thing. So really, get off it. I mean, they're not going to really continue to push the nuclear threat narrative. They won't be able to after this, right?
Well, no, I don't think they're going to be pushing the nuclear threat narrative as an active problem.
Instead, their narrative now is, oh no, now they have money and they'll spend it all on Hezbollah.
Right. That's going to be the primary propaganda theme, but they will not have given up the idea that it was our heroic diplomacy and the pressure on Iran that brought this about. So, I mean, in other words, they're going to have it both ways. Obviously, that's the aim, and that's what they will.
I mean, that in itself isn't too bad, other than if, problems that it sets us up for, right? Like, I don't care if they call Afghanistan a victory, if they would just get the hell out, you know?
Well, I mean, of course, we want to have changes in the immediate policy that are in the right direction. We agree on that. But, the direction that the Obama administration's policy in the Middle East is going is absolutely the wrong direction at this point. It's not heading in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry to say that I am a pessimist on, you know, how this agreement is going to influence the direction of that policy in the future.
Which direction is the right direction? Because both directions are horrible, right? We're either backing the jihadists like we are in Syria, those still loyal to Zawahiri, if not, you know, directly backing the Islamic State, still their clones, or we're backing Iran and the Badr Brigades that helped turn Iraq into the giant cemetery that it is right now.
Which of those is
the right position?
What we should be doing is recognizing that Iran is a legitimate player in the Middle East, that it has legitimate security interests, that what it has been doing in Syria, in Lebanon, is defending the most elementary self-defense national security interests that a country can have in the face of overt threats from Israel and previous to that from the Bush administration. The Hezbollah's rockets are an essential, fundamental element in the Iranian deterrent to Israeli attack. And, secondarily to U.S. attack, should a Republican administration come back into office with that sort of rhetoric. And so, I mean, this is obviously the opposite of what the Obama administration is presenting as the reality in the Middle East. But, what I'm saying is that without recognizing that reality, we are still in a situation where the United States is backing actively the most destructive, destabilizing elements in the region. And that has to stop.
Well, and Obama's almost out of time, and he's about to be replaced by somebody even worse than him on all of this stuff.
Exactly. I mean, that's what is so worrisome, that he is not doing anything to put up, his administration is not doing anything to put up any barriers to the next administration continuing to carry out a policy, an aggressive policy in the Middle East that is aimed at regime change. I'm not saying that the Obama administration is actively pursuing regime change, but it would be relatively easier for the next administration to go back to the Bush administration regime change strategy because of what the Obama administration is doing.
Yeah, well, I don't know, though. I mean, it seems like, again, in the near-term future, what we're going to be hearing most about from Iran is how their guys are kicking the Islamic State's ass in Fallujah, right? Or losing to them, but fighting our enemies. supposedly.
Well, I mean, that, of course, is the reality. There's no doubt about that. But is the Obama administration saying that? No, they're not. They're not saying that at all. They're continuing to say that Iran is the troublemaker throughout the region.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is of course, a response in part, as I've said on your show before, to the vested interests of the national security state in the United States, but also to response to pressure from the allies who have leverage with the national security state because, you know, that's where our military bases are, first of all, and they're not going to give them up.
Yeah. All right. Well, now, so they seem to be waffling on this. I guess they've been waffling on it all along, right, about whether they really want regime change in Syria or not. But then Obama just 2 weeks ago now said Assad must step down. I believe that's the first time he said that since 2012.
The rhetoric has definitely hardened, no question about it. I mean, all along the line, every aspect of U.S. Middle Eastern policy has gone much harder line, more aggressive, more anti-Iran, and more prepared to support the destabilization that is being carried out by U.S. allies. I mean, this is an extremely a worrisome trend, which is not being discussed openly by the news media at all. I mean, you know, this is kind of being covered up or hailed by the news media as, you know, well, now they're heading in the right direction, either one of the two.
Well, now, so, okay, go back to the Iraq War II there, George Jr.'s war, 03 through 11. Oops, benefited Iran, was supposed to hurt them, rode through Damascus and Hezbollah and Tehran, all run through Baghdad, and we're going to rule the region. It ended up really blowing up in their face. So then, trying to make a long story short here, redirection. Right, 2007, Hirsch says, hey, they decided that we really screwed up by fighting a war for Iran, so now we're going to switch back to the Sunnis. And then I don't know if you exactly include the awakening in that, but you do include support for, you know, bin Ladenite-type movements in Lebanon, in Syria, and as well as in eastern Iran with the Jandala there. And then I think he even included Kurdish, anti-Iranian Kurdish groups as well. And so, you know, Obama seemed to be sticking with that. If you go to his interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in 2012, where he says, that's right, Jeffrey Goldberg, getting rid of Assad would be a great way to bring Iran down a peg. And that's what we're doing. And I can't tell you too much about what we're doing because it's all classified. One of those almost, I'd tell you, but I'd have to kill you kind of joking about it sort of thing.
Right. And one of the great untold stories about the Obama administration's policy is how, for the first 4 years of the administration, they weren't about the diplomacy at all. They were about pressure on Iran. Right.
I'm sorry, I take way too long, but I'm trying to get to the question, which is that, I mean, is this all just so ham-handed that, well, there's a fire here, try to put it out, and there's a nuclear program here, and I really want to do that for politics? Or is it possible that they decided to go back to something like that they think is smart, like the offshore balancing? Is that what this is? Is the 20-teens version of, you know, let them all fight amongst each other, that kind of stuff? Or
I think that's far too sophisticated to be attributed to the Obama administration.
That's what Stephen Walt said,
seriously.
Too. Stephen
seriously.
Walt, the realist guy's like, come on, for these guys to do anything on purpose is a level of sophistication I just can't believe in.
Totally agree. I mean, you know, we have to stop talking in terms that attribute sort of smart academic conceptions to this administration. I mean, they're just in a totally different place. Mm-hmm. They're in a place of constructing alternative realities, you know, basically constructing facts that are convenient to their political interests.
Right.
That's really
the way
I would describe what has been going on in the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't taken a look trolling through the Hillary Clinton emails, but I did read a thing where Nick Gillespie talked about just what a average person she seems like. You know, like here's this person with so much power and she's just so average in her thinking. She doesn't have anything like the context she would learn from talking with you all the time like I get. You know what I mean?
Well,
and ain't that interested in the first place.
That's totally predictable, isn't it? I mean, people who have the power do not have any incentive to acquire a frame of an analytical reference that is going to be critical.
Right.
I mean, that just goes...
Why would they?
That.
Yeah, and remember that Washington Post story a couple years ago where Susan Rice took some staffers on a Saturday and they sat around in a empty wing of the State Department offices and they got a big white piece of paper and they decided, let's write up a new foreign policy on this whiteboard here, and what we'll do is we'll do this big pivot to Asia. We'll just forget about the Middle East because that's pretty much all over with now. And and this is at a time where Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is spreading down into Mali and the whole place is on fire. You know, they're spreading jihad all over the damn place. And right as she's thinking that this is a perfect time to go and contain China.
Yeah, yeah, it's a wonderful example of how things get constructed so conveniently for the political interests of the people in power. I mean, you know, it has nothing whatever to do with reality on the ground.
All right, but now back to the nuclear program. I mean, isn't it the case, as we've been saying for years, that this is, as I've been putting it anyway, that this is the gigantic fake outstanding issue, the outstanding issue between us and Iran that makes a normal relationship impossible, and now they put the damn thing to bed, Gareth. So now, I mean, there's got to be some hope in that, no?
Well, you know, again, it's all relative. I mean, yes, it's better that they've solved the problem. It takes the immediate contradiction down several pegs. No question about that. But it does leave a residual effect on the political atmosphere in this country. It enables the extreme right to continue to carry on their fabrications, their political lies about Iran. It enables them, essentially, and it creates a false discussion around the whole question of policy toward Iran. It creates this false dilemma, if you will, excluding, you know, a whole series of possibilities that the administration doesn't want to talk about, and including possibilities that the right wing, extreme right wing, wants to talk about. So, I mean, it's still problematic, is all I'm saying. It's problematic politically.
There's a silver lining there, too, though, because that could help prevent America from working too closely with Iran and Iraq. And I want to see absolutely none of that anymore. I'm tired of America fighting for Iran and Iraq.
Well, I mean, I'm with you. I mean, I'm ready to take the position. It's time for this is the moment when the United States should get out of the Middle East militarily.
Your phone's getting all fuzzy on me there, Gareth. I'm sorry. Can you jump on your cord or something?
Okay, no cord. This is cordless, but what I'm saying is that this is the moment, in my view, for the United States to get out of the Middle East militarily, lock, stock, and barrel. There's no longer even the slightest hint of a rationale for the United States remaining there to have the threat of military intervention, or the idea that the United States is in some fashion going to be making a difference in regard to terrorism in the Middle East. It's not going to happen. And so,
certainly,
you know,
not a positive one.
Not a positive one, exactly. We can have a negative one, but not a positive one.
Yeah, in fact, there's this brand new quote out from a Special Forces General, Flynn, I believe it is, saying that exact same thing.
Yes,
that the Iraq war and the drone war, this whole project, has made the terrorism problem worse, not better.
And this is one of the most right-wing people who's been in the government recently. So
yeah, in fact, he's still saying we ought to be doing more against ISIS and Iran, but he's willing to admit that much anyway.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but and don't you love that? He still wants to fight both of them, the enemies, Iran and the Islamic State.
There's no consideration here to consistency, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right, now, at least do you think that it's pretty much a safe bet that the Republicans will not be able to have the votes to override the president's veto, at least for what it is?
Well, the reality at the moment. I mean, you know, I wouldn't want to count on it. This is not a predictable universe that we inhabit politically. And, you know, I think it's still a serious problem that needs to be carefully considered. And if there was anything that could be done to counter the machinations of the Israeli lobby in these states where they're going to target swing Democrats in the Senate, then that absolutely needs to be done. That's for sure.
Yep. All right, everybody. That is the heroic Gareth Porter. He's the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Truth Behind the Iran Nuclear Scare. and he writes for Middle East Eye and for truthout.org. And in fact, let me tell you here, the latest two are how a weaker Iran got the hegemon to lift sanctions. That's at Middle East Eye, and then at Truthout, how three of the Iran negotiations' toughest issues were resolved. Thanks very much for your time again, Gareth.
Glad to be on again. Thanks, Scott.
All right, Sean, that's the show. Thanks.